Please explain again. When one restores concentration by focusing on the in and out take of the breath, is one using the vijnana, consciousness, of the grasping mind? And you just have to say depends. It depends whether you're grasping or not. So that's the... you have to do... You actually have to do something. Not everything that we do is grasping or clinging. It's like the... I mentioned the set of teachings that the Buddha gave, which were the four bases of success or spiritual success. And the first factor for success in one's spiritual practice is in the Pali word is chanda, and it's desire. But it's more like desire in terms of motivation or interest to be able to direct the mind skillfully, so that one relies on desire, motivation, in order to bring up energy, to be able to investigate, to direct attention. It isn't possible to say to not direct the attention. It's because I think there's sometimes our conception of spiritual practice or spiritual accomplishment is we should have a non-directed mind, or have a mind that is attached to anything. But then that gets really woolly and not particularly useful, actually. So the Buddha's instructions are to be able to learn how to use the mind, apply the mind skillfully, both for the accomplishing of what is good and wholesome, as well as for relinquishment and liberation. And that it takes a directing of attention. During retreats, I sometimes have dreams in which my actions are unskillful. Does one eventually keep the precepts even in dreams? It's true, and it happens. I think especially sometimes as monks, because in the dream world, can get really. Kind of wild and wonderful. But I know with the precepts, even in the dreams, you sort of, where are my robes? Did I forget my robe? There is a mention of referring to Ajahn Chah saying that exercise makes the body strong and inner stillness makes the mind strong. Sort of why stillness and not awareness? I think it's just sometimes in using language and making images, there's always I say that there's never the perfect image. So then that in the sense of exercise, it's sort of like activity. Especially in Thai, it's sort of like activity. It's like contrasting the difference between activity and stillness, so that it's the activity that makes the body strong, but it's sort of the stillness and stopping that makes the mind strong. And in other ways, Ajahn Chah would praise the use and development of awareness, but in this case, it's just using an image and trying to, and also sometimes just playing with language. Because Ajahn Chah used to do that a lot, playing with images, playing with language. It has been a few years since my last retreat. May I request a reminder on how to practice metta meditation on oneself sometime during this retreat? I seem to have forgotten. It's really important. I made a kind of oblique reference the other day, probably, but that laying a foundation of loving kindness is such an important basis for kind of right intention when we begin the practice, and to recognize that really all of the things that we're doing is an opportunity to develop that sense of kindness and caring for oneself as a foundation and a beginning. And then when we are able to do that, to whatever degree we're able to establish a kindly attitude toward ourselves, that inevitably spreads out and encompasses others, so that the reality is putting aside different things that one could be doing and coming on to retreat is already an act of loving kindness, and to actually recollect that. To make that conscious, because sometimes we don't attend so closely to the underlying implications of an action. We sort of get caught in the action, and then forget that, well, actually, underneath that, there's this. Especially with coming on retreat, helping out with within the retreat, joining in with other people who are like-minded. These are all acts of loving kindness. But it also it's good to make it very overt and use the to articulate that within the mind, and using the phrases of, like we do in the chanting, of may I abide in well-being, may I be happy. I mean, let's say ahang sukito homi, may I abide in well-being. May I be happy. May I be free from the different things that stress the mind. one of the sometimes the phrases that come up in the chanting, like the Buddha's words on loving kindness, as an example, as a phrase or a sentence, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. It's sort of just to be able to bring those phrases up and to be repeating them, not just to repeat the phrase, but to recollect the intention behind it and the opportunity to set that intention of loving kindness, because it's an important aspect of how to. Because we do need to have a fundamental base of well-being in order to, just to live our life, but particularly in meditation and our cultivation of this path, sometimes we think of the meditation as something that we're, and if we could just get our meditation together, then it'd feel good. And once I get my meditation together, then I'll be happy. And the Buddha doesn't actually teach that. He teaches the opposite. He says, you get your happiness together, then your meditation falls into place. So there's a stock phrases in the suttas where giving causal links and conditions, and there's different starting points, and some of it is starting from virtue, some of it starting from wholesome thoughts, some of it is around the delight in Dhamma, some of it is beginning from wise attention, but then it falls into a pattern of because of the various starting points as a cause, then there's the arising of well-being or of delight, pamoja, and then with well-being as a cause, then there's the arising of joy. With joy as a condition, there's the arising of tranquility. With tranquility as a condition, there's the arising of happiness. With happiness as a condition, there's the arising of samadhi. And then the Buddha, in many discourses, stops and emphasizes that and says, the happy mind is easily concentrated. So that to pay attention to the things that allow the mind to experience happiness. And loving kindness is a fundamental foundation for that sense of well-being and ease and happiness. So that sometimes, people sort of, it's like, well, I don't have time for that metta practice. I got to get on to the real meditation. It's not that at all. What one is doing is laying the foundations of these wholesome states of mind, states of well-being, states of happiness, that then allow the mind to settle, to sort of shed the area, the aspects where we tend to create suffering. So that a conscious directing of attention to loving kindness, and particularly directing it toward oneself, establishing that as a firm basis, is for basic good health. If you're an athlete, then you want to be sort of looking after your health and getting nutrition and whatnot. If you're a meditator, you want to be looking after loving kindness and making sure that's a solid foundation. Oh, would you please give an example of how wholesome qualities can condition unwholesome qualities? I sit here meditating, watching my breath, and my mind starts to get bright and peaceful, and then, my mind's really bright and peaceful. Now I've got it. Bad idea. the Pali word pamada is. Heedlessness, being heedless, being kind of sloppy with what one's mind is doing, and so then, not being circumspect, then one opens oneself up for unwholesome creep into the mind. The mind changes, and it's one of the Buddha points to appamada or heedfulness or circumspection as one of the important or essential qualities for growth in the Dhamma, so that we cultivate that heedfulness and care and circumspection, even around wholesome states, because the mind changes. That's what happens. Okay, I feel like a kid whose father has told a story and there is more to tell. I can't wait to know more about those other kinds of thoughts. You told us about the non-complicated ones. What else? Please, Father, do tell. There. Just get to the non-complication first. I have a hard time ending or letting go of relationships after they no longer serve me or prove to be with unskillful people. I stay longer than I should. Is this attachment to person or aversion, fear, etc. of the unknown or ? Well, yeah, those are the questions that we need to be asking ourselves. And when you recognize a pattern and recognize that it no longer serves you, it really doesn't, isn't for one's well-being, then whatever the reason, however it's justified or how one casts it in the mind, then we need to be finding ways to be more skillful and more wise in how we deal with things. And it is helpful to 'cause there are certain patterns that we tend to follow as a particular temperament, so that we'll our default options can be attachment in terms of because we're more of a greed type, so we attach to people, where we hold on, and we're to situations because our default option is more toward greed, but then other people might follow a similar pattern, but then it's out of fear of like fear of the unknown, fear of having to deal with something new, where and oftentimes, it isn't absolutely black and white. We mix those things up. But it's helpful to look and sort of see, well, what's this? What is the kind of the default option of the mind? And we do, we do that in ordinary circumstances, and then we do that in things that, in terms of our relationships, and so it shines light on, okay, this is where I really need to, I've got work to do in this area. I've got to learn how to work with fear or work with desire, in order to understand it and not let it drive my choices. So then, because you recognize that when we understand it more clearly, it doesn't mean that we don't have defilements and attachments, but understanding oneself more clearly, the alarm bells go off a bit quicker, which is helpful. How do you decrease the times an obsessive thought arises in the mind? The more I try to let it go and come back to my body, the more it arises and proliferates. If I do the opposite and turn attention to it, it does the same thing. What is obsession anyways? The obsession is the self of identification with it. Sort of like, this is my thought. I think one of the things that's helpful is just holding that as a question. What is my thought anyway? Why do I identify with it? Why is it a problem? Because it's that that feeling of ownership and identification, it doesn't, especially with thoughts that are kind of obsessive, it isn't as if they just sort of hover around the edges of consciousness. You know, they'll sort of kind of reach up and grab you by the neck. And so it's helpful to recognize their power, but also sort of start looking at how we identify with it, or identify it as my problem. Because oftentimes the thought doesn't actually have to be all that consequential, but we'll just obsess over it. But then much of the obsession is sort of my obsession with this thought. And so it's the it's this sense of me that is oftentimes intruding, and to be able to see the pain and the bane of that that kind of perspective and that position, and recognize that we can relinquish that. And you know, if you weren't on retreat, it probably wouldn't even come up. I mean, the thought sort of passes through the mind. It's just more of like random thoughts come and go. And as soon as we get on retreat and try to get rid of them, then it turns into a problem. So that sort of looking at that, you know, why do I obsess with it? Why do I create that me around that? I've been sitting on this question the past few days. It has to do with dispassion, shedding, simplifying, and being easily satisfied on one end of the spectrum, and being engaged and active in the world, even taking an unpopular stand on the other end. How can one practice shedding internally, but still be responsive and engaged regarding the suffering from environmental and social issues? It seems that would complicate things, but that is where my heart is drawn. I think one of the things is when one pays attention to suffering, and then the when there is a dispassion and shedding, a clarity arises in the mind, which can then more easily be applied to something that is useful or beneficial without complicating things. Because sometimes what is, especially in terms of social issues, sometimes what burns people out is the complicated reactions that we have. And when we're able to be clear and see a need that needs a response, then we can put our effort and energy in a way that doesn't burn ourselves out and doesn't create problems for others. In the sense, there tends to be there can easily be all of the personality issues and competitions that happen between people. If one can sidestep that and stick with the issue at hand that one wants to be of service towards, then that's a huge advantage, both in terms of actually accomplishing something as well as not burning oneself out. And that's really important. And also, if one picks up an issue that one feels it's important to one, then when one can come at it with a clarity and a contentment with one's own intention and wish to help and be of service, then the gratification is in the action itself rather than many of the complicated things that we rely on in human interaction. So that, I mean, one just an example from myself. When I was in Thailand, I established a non-profit and working with environmental issues, education, forest protection, alternative livelihood for villagers, and a lot of it came from myself being a forest monk and then seeing the forest disappearing. And I remember talking with some people one time, and we're talking about the problems that particular issue was facing, which were immense, and then somebody asked me, "Do you think there's any hope for saving all the forests in Thailand?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Well, how can you do this and put this energy in if you think there's no hope?" I said, "I don't think there's hope in terms of that it's going to make a huge impact right now. I'm just planting the seeds for the future, and maybe something will change, but it's not an option not to do it." And so that finding ways to lay foundations and possibilities for the future, so that sense of having enough clarity and understanding the problems, and it frees one up to put effort into something that is on one level you think, "Oh, it's a hopeless cause," but even if it's you think it's a hopeless cause, it doesn't mean one doesn't do it or can't do it or even enjoy doing it. So that's a perspective. Okay. "Could you please explain again the differences between sanya, sankhara, and vijnana? I'm still not getting it. Thanks." What comes to mind is on a technical level, the sanya is more like memory, perception, association. Sankhara is the thoughts, emotions. Vijnana is the consciousness or the conscious awareness of the sense impressions that we have. But what comes to mind is Ajahn Chah talking about the dependent origination and the 12 links in dependent origination, and how the condition nature of how beginning with ignorance of avijja, as a condition, there's a rising of sankhara. The sankhara's condition is rising of vijnana. Vijnana's condition, rising of the sense bases, and so on through sense contact and desire, attachment, becoming, and Ajahn Chah, I remember him saying, you know, he said, all those links in the dependent origination, all those the details of the process, it's kind of like falling out of a tree. Then, as you're going down, you're not really counting the branches. You just know that when you hit the bottom, it's going to hurt. So that you know, and sometimes it is that okay. Which is sanya? Which is sankara? Which is vijnana? It's not to get too worried, but just to recognize, okay, where does my mind go, and what is it that conditions that feeling of dukkha, of discontent, dissatisfaction, dis-ease? Is there an obligation to reconcile with family before your death or theirs? I feel disgust about things my stepfather has said and done, both recently and in the past. I wonder if he truly cannot see beyond himself, and I wonder if I should bother. The last time I saw him, he sexually harassed me. Now he has sent a half-hearted apology 1.5 years later. I'm not sure what I want or what I should do. He'll be 80 soon. Thank you for any guidance. I mean, there's a... I mean, these are all very individual, and one has to make you know, kind of choices. But I think there's a difference between forgiveness and reconciliation, so that forgiveness is an opportunity for oneself to forgive in a way that one is able to relinquish aversion and resentment and then being able to set that behind one. And, you know, reconciliation is a lot more complicated, and then is it possible? Is it even worth it? Those are different questions. But I think it particularly in terms of practitioners, then we have to find ways where other people's past actions are not a source of our repeated feelings of anger or even a vengeful state or a resentment, in order to be able to let them go and free our own minds, to be able to set it aside. And that, and sometimes it just isn't worth it in terms of an actual physical meeting, because it brings up so many mixed and complicated feelings and reactions, and then, and if one has seen a pattern repeating over time, then you know, well, I don't really want to feed that or buy into that anymore. So that finding ways, but I think And forgiveness is all in the sense that one recognizes that somebody, both oneself and others, but you know, when we're thinking of individuals, you know, okay, that's a and especially if they've done something that has wronged one, then that recognition that you know, that is action based on delusion, ignorance, unskillfulness, and to be able to kind of depersonalize it, and in order to set it aside and let it go. Sort of those actions, any actions that are unskillful like that, result in suffering for others and suffering for that person, and that's the basis of equanimity, is when one can look not in a personal way, but look in terms of actions, and because of actions, those results come into being. And I don't need to say have some kind of revenge or some kind of resolution to it. That's their actions. That's where, and they're the owners of their actions. I don't want to pick it up. I don't want to carry it. I can relinquish that. And that's a kindness toward oneself. It's a way of coming to a place of forgiveness. But there may not be reconciliation. And in many cases, there might not need to be reconciliation because it's just too complicated. Ties into the next question. What is meant by fools when the Buddha says, don't associate with fools? His definition of a fool. Well, a fool in Bala is somebody who that's the word in Pali. And Pala is somebody who chooses unskillful action over skillful. That's who the Buddha would say is, and somebody who obviously is a repeat offender in that category. So that somebody who you can pretty much count on them, doing something unwholesome, unskillful, inappropriate, when they have the option to do what is good. Is there anything skillful about crying? The flow of tears. Well, a lot of it, I guess, it just really depends. I mean, some of it is. Just in is a natural response. It's a an emotional response or a empathetic response. It's a way of responding to situations. Really depends. I think it's more. I think it's sometimes you don't really choose. It's skillful and unskillful is something that you actually choose. And sometimes with I guess there's and especially when it's empathetic and Or when it's, sometimes there's an honesty there okay, this is what it feels like. And it's something sad or something isn't as if one is, it can make a really conscious choice about it. It's just sort of very natural. How does one reconcile the apparent lack of control that is experienced in meditation, if one is paying close attention, with the apparent need to control one's circumstances off the cushion? Is it possible to live with complete non-contention and still have an organized life? I think one of the things is recognizing especially that aspect of control or need to control, and because I think there's assumptions that we make that if we were kind of completely spontaneous and in complete accord with all circumstances, that it would all be very spontaneous and one wouldn't need there, and it would just, there would be either no need to control, or there would be no control. It would just, everything would unfold naturally. And that's whether internally or externally. But the reality is that, there's always a balance that we need to be paying attention to, in the sense that, like in meditation, there are certain areas that we can control, and then there are certain areas where we need to relinquish control and let things fall into place, so that we can have a certain control over our posture, we can have a certain control over our directing of attention, but there's a lack of control over how peaceful one will be, how quickly one would become peaceful. That's, one has a lack of control. And so there's areas where we can affect change, and then there's other areas where we have to just really let go and let it unfold as it will. And actually the same thing in, say, off the cushion, in ordinary life, we do need to make very skillful choices as to where we can exercise some kind of control, have some kind of organization and structure to our life, and then how the results unfold, we have to keep monitoring that. We have to keep watching that, and to see what happens. Now, one of the aspects of think of control and think of So the example of the Buddha, he fully enlightened being, and and encouraged other people to practice to liberate themselves as well, be fully enlightened. And he gave very particular instructions on how to in terms of conduct in body, speech, and mind. And then when it comes to the actual, say, particularly for monastics, then the kind of structures for conduct, I mean, there's real organization there. Or the example of when the Buddha was first enlightened, and he spent the rains in Benares, or outside of Benares, at Sarnath, at the deer park. And during the rainy season, stayed. And then from those first five disciples, then various people from the surrounding area started to come and receive teachings. And then by the end of that rains retreat, after the rains were over then and the weather cleared, there were 60 arhats, 60 enlightened beings. And then the Buddha said, after the rain subsided, said, okay, everybody, go off in separate directions. You know what needs to be, and go for the and go and teach and encourage others, for the benefit and welfare of everybody. But he said, I'm going back to Gayasisa, which was very close to where he was enlightened at, and Bodh Gaya. And it was a very clear intention, thought through, and he taught. He went and taught a group of fire worshippers, religious seekers of practitioners of another persuasion or philosophical persuasion, and in order to lay a foundation for his own teaching. And he had a plan. And after teaching those, that, because he was there were three brothers who had a large following. And they were the most respected religious practitioners in the samanas. The Brahmins were their own kind of caste and religious basis. So the samanas, the kind of meditators and practitioners, they were the most respected samanas in the area, in Magadha. Magadha was the most important region in India at the time. The Buddha knew what he was doing and taught those. They became his students. Then he went with that group and went and visited King Bimbisara, who was the king of Magadha. You know, within a year, the Buddha had pretty much had India sewn up. So that was really organized. He was really thinking through, okay, what's going to be beneficial? How do I use my time skillfully? How do I use my How do I do this? So that, you know, I think, you know, there is this, one has to recognize that whatever actions we do, they do have a result. And to be willing to pay attention, because there's somehow you know, in our conception of spiritual practice, that there's a, it's all kind of works magically, and no, it works according to causes and conditions, and whether it's an internal or whether it's external, that's the nature of the world we inhabit. So that using our wisdom and discernment to see, okay, how to apply oneself skillfully to the causes and conditions that will be for my own benefit and for the benefit of others. Yeah. And that's a, it's actually pretty simple. But we have to be clear and also recognize that, you know, things don't always work the way we conceive of it. And that's where we need to let go, where we have to that we have to give in to, well, this is the way it is. So that that developing of a balance of control and relinquishing control, you have to pay attention to what actually is, because there are some areas where you really have to take responsibility and not taking responsibility is kind of foolish. And so that, but then, yeah, sort of taking responsibility to the point of being a control freak, that's suffering for oneself and for others. So it's always a balance. But the point of investigation is okay, where is the suffering? Where is the end of suffering? So right now for me, the end of suffering is a bathroom break. So have a break, come back for puja.